I did a little bit of digging because last week we had a little bit of a hang-up with one of the questions. In the introduction, we were looking at the city of Babylon, and we stopped right at the last thing that I was going to talk about regarding the city of Babylon, just to kind of give us an idea of where Daniel was at, what he and his three friends were going to be looking at, in contrast to the city of Jerusalem. Babylon was a great city. It was very fortified. It had those, remember, the 11 miles of wall with these huge bronze gates that were up. And as they entered into the city, they saw the temple of the gods specifically, and that's where the hang-up was. Who was the principal god of the Babylonians? Some of us came up with Baal. Some of us came up with Marduk. And Dave, the oddball, came up with Anu. So they didn't really sit right with me because it seemed like there should really be only one principal god. So I did some looking into that. And what I found out is that Dave is right, that Anu is one of the principal gods of the Babylonians. But through time, that has transitioned from Anu to another god called Enlil. And then finally to another god, when we come to the book of Daniel, Marduk. So if you go back to ancient Babylonian, ancient Mesopotamian history, that's where you've got Anu being the principal god of those people. But just through time, that for some reason or another changed. And as their religion evolved and as it grew, when we get to the day of Daniel, Marduk is the principal god during that day and time. So if you look at it from that perspective, well, everybody was really right. So you may remember also that Baal, B-E-L, is also referred to as Marduk. So as we considered that, and as we considered the city of Babylon, there is, once again, just a layout to give you an idea of what the city might have looked like. And it's divided into, remember, the east and the west sides. On the eastern side, you have what's called Old Babylon. That's where the temple of Marduk was at. And you can kind of see that represented right there. And then across from that, also on the east side of the Euphrates River, which ran through the middle of the city, you have the palace. There at the palace would have been the garrison, the king's guards, his elite soldiers, his royal harem, his workers, his administrative staff, all of them would be staying at the palace. And so when Daniel enlists into service with King Nebuchadnezzar, he would be one of the ones probably dwelling at the palace, serving in the administration role that he's going to fulfill. And then you may remember on the other side you have what's called Neo-Babylonia. That is actually the New Babylon, and that's really where the residential areas was at. That's on the west side of the Euphrates River. So pretty much you had the palace and the temple on the east side and the residential area there on the west. The only thing that we really didn't get to speak of regarding the city of Babylonia that I had in mind was the Hanging Gardens. What the Hanging Gardens were is they were one of the seven wonders of the world that was built by King Nebuchadnezzar. What had happened, Nebuchadnezzar was given a wife from the Persian king. And I remember, you remember me telling you how sometimes kings would send the most powerful king their daughters and things like that so that they might establish that political relationship with the ruling king of the world. Nebuchadnezzar being king of the most powerful Babylonian empire at this time, thus would be receiving that sort of tribute from subservient kingdoms. And so he takes this Persian woman as wife, but the land of Babylon was very flat, it was very hot, and she was used to a more mountainous region, and she was depressed, the story is told, because of the flatness and the heat and the culture of Babylon. And so what he did was he designed this hanging garden to kind of give it an appearance of her homeland, and in doing so to make her happy and to appease her and to place her in an environment with which she would have been more accustomed. So the Hanging Gardens was attributed to King Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon, and he built that for his Persian wife in an attempt to please her, but to provide her with a more realistic environment of her home. So with that said, as we considered the city of Babylon, and we looked at all of that for the purpose of helping us understand what it was Daniel and his friends were going to be walking into. How for them it was going to be a complete culture shock, and all of the temples that were there, the foreign gods, the way that the city operated, all of those things are going to weigh in on Daniel and press upon Daniel and challenge his faith. And I hope that you can appreciate what he would witness whenever he walked into this ancient city of Babylon from the small town of Jerusalem in contrast. So, without any further ado, we're going to just enter into our study. We're going to take it a verse at a time. We'll have questions along the way. Comments and questions will be more than welcome as we begin to study the text. Chapter 1, verse 1 begins saying, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it." So, verse 1 kind of gives us a historical context in which we can take the book of Daniel and we can determine when did these events occur. You can look at Judah history and you can look at the history of the Babylonians, and you don't have to use the Bible. And you can see when these events are beginning to take place, and they identify for us during the third reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah and during the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar II. So that's whenever all of these events begin to take place. We'll stop here for a question and see if we can have a little bit of discussion from our audience. Question 3, what does the Bible tell us about King Jehoiakim? And I think James answered for us last week, and we didn't get one or two questions in. Jimmy Doe, did you do question 2 last week? Okay. Mr. Stanton, would you mind? Do you have this, or we can just start with you, and if you don't want to answer, we can just open it up. Okay. Just think back a little bit to Old Testament history. We did a little bit of reading into Jehoiakim, king of Judah. What are some things that we know about him the Bible tells us? Okay. Pharaoh Necho?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Okay, like him to Jehoiakim. All right, Robert, were you going to say something? Okay, he had no respect for the Word of God. And we looked, in fact, I guess a couple weeks back whenever we were studying, Jehoiakim was the king that whenever Jeremiah, you may remember Jeremiah was prophet in the city of Jerusalem and witnessed its destruction when Nebuchadnezzar finally comes in a few years later after the book of Daniel starts and just absolutely destroys Jerusalem, raises the temple. Jeremiah was prophet in the city at that time, and he speaks words from God and writes them down on a scroll. And this is actually while he's in prison, and he commands one of the eunuchs, I can't remember the eunuch's name, he commands one of the eunuchs to take the scroll from God and to take it to King Jehoiakim. So he takes it there, and it comes into the hands of King Jehoiakim, and as he's there among his advisors, he opens it up, they begin reading that scroll. And it says 3 or 4 lines in, he literally takes a knife and he doesn't like what he's hearing. He cuts that scroll in half and throws it into the fire. Essentially his response to the word of God that was being given to him through the prophet Jeremiah was that he didn't want to hear it. And so he cut it up and had no more respect for it than to just cut it up and throw it into the fire. So he was a man that had disrespect for God. He was an evil man like Robert mentioned. Dave? Okay. Okay. So, and that kind of summarizes Jehoiakim's life in a nutshell. You consider his father, Josiah. Was Josiah one of the good or the bad kings? One of the good kings. In fact, if you look back and you look at what Josiah did something that none of the other good kings did before him. That is, he purified Israel, he restored temple worship, to the degree that other good kings that came along and sought to follow God's word, but they stopped short every time. And what they failed to do is they failed to cast down the high places that were built up during the days of Solomon. But Josiah goes so far to restore worship according to the pattern and the principle given by Moses, that he tears down those high places and he cleansed Jerusalem and he restored the city to worshiping God the way they would be. And it's sad to consider and somewhat prideful to consider this one of the greatest kings of Israel. Perhaps even rivalry the righteousness and the work of David. To have a son so evil and so awful with such a disrespect for God's word. You could go and you could read in Jeremiah 22:13-19. One of the things that Jehoiakim did was he didn't really care at all for his people. He was a man who was selfish. He was a man that pursued his own interests, and rather than taking and using the funds of the city and the funds of his nation to benefit the people, what he does is he takes and he builds on to the palace. He begins to create the palace that he lived in more to his liking, disregarding the needs of the people, disregarding the needs of his citizens. So he was a selfish man. He disregarded the word of God. They cut up that scroll, threw it into the fire. It was an awful guy. And he's going to rebel against the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. And he's later carried off to the city of Babylon, where he's going to eventually, his life will come to an end. So we're told that all of this occurred in the third year of his reign. you may remember that Israel was free during the days of King Josiah and during the collapse of the Assyrian kingdom. However, it came to a point whenever Josiah died and his son took over, his oldest son took over, he did not follow in his father's footsteps, and so God used Pharaoh Necho, who Tommy pointed out, to come down and essentially to make Judah a tribute to that powerful nation of Egypt. So he goes and he forces Jehoiakim to pay tribute to the Egyptians and has them in a somewhat subservient position. So he became a vassal to Egypt, and that was around 609, and he remained in that state for about 4 years. Now, what had happened, Assyria is going to go to war at the Battle of Carchemish with the Babylonians. We talked about that a little bit. And they're essentially defeated at the Battle of Carchemish. Now, Egypt also went up to help Assyria because Egypt and Assyria were allies. And so both Egypt and Assyria were pretty much defeated at the Battle of Carchemish. And what Nebuchadnezzar does, and we don't have our map, but in northwest Assyria, you've got Carchemish where the battle took place, and you've got the Mediterranean Sea a little bit south of it. Emperor Necho and the Egyptian army had marched on the east side of the Mediterranean River up to Carchemish to help the Assyrians fight the Babylonians. But the Babylonians defeat both of them, and so when Nebuchadnezzar then begins to travel south down the east side of the Mediterranean Sea, going to finish his victory against Egypt. And along the way, he comes across Judah, and he makes Judah his tributary. He makes them his nation. So Judah's no longer paying tribute to the land of Egypt. Now they're paying tribute to the Babylonians. So all of this is beginning to take place in the third year of Jehoiakim, who was king at that time. And we're going to see verse 2 kind of tells us what takes place from there. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. The language that's used there to describe this event that's taking place, and from the outside looking in, we might say that King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came in and he overthrew the land of Judah. He made them captive. He made them servants. But the Bible describes it in a different way. And when you place God within the context of all of this, this wasn't just some arbitrary battle that didn't go well for King Jehoiakim. And we'll stop here for our fourth question. And this occurs in several times throughout the book. What instances was God involved, and was his involvement miraculous or providential? Okay. Okay. You go read through the prophets, and God talks about judgment that's coming on all of these various nations, and Egypt is one of the ones that's going to be punished. And not only is Assyria destroyed, but also Egypt is beat to a point where they're no longer going to be a world power at this point in time. And so you've got God kind of meeting out judgment on multiple people now. Ultimately, it's to what end? It's to the end of the captivity of Judah, right? God's punishment for his own people, but along the way Assyria is defeated, along the way Egypt is defeated, judgment is brought on both of those. But did you note the language that was used there in that text? We don't have Daniel writing and describing a battle takes place where the king of Babylon comes in and he does this. Rather, you've got God, the Lord, gives Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the hand of Babylon, of King Nebuchadnezzar. And there's a couple of other instances where you've got involvement from God, where you've got things that are taking place, and yes, they're through the hands of man. They're accomplished by, like, King Nebuchadnezzar here, but you've got God involved with the one who's actually behind the scenes that's working this for his purpose. Because you may remember, God had prophesied through the prophet Jeremiah that destruction is going to come upon Judah, that they were going to be punished, that this was God's means of retribution and judgment on them for their disobedience, for their idol worship, because of the fact that they neglected the prophets who came and multiple times told them, you need to turn around, you need to return and worship God, you need to put your idols away. And so Jeremiah comes along and he says, you know, God's had it. Judgment is going to come. In fact, he even, through the prophet Jeremiah, says that you're going to be in Babylon for 70 years. So he goes as far to tell the children of Israel how long they're going to be punished for. But it's for a purpose. And it's for the purpose of bringing, I think, ultimately, the people back to God. It's judgment upon their disobedience, but it's to bring the people back to God, because you have the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. What happens in those books after the children of Israel are released? Okay, they go back to Jerusalem. They inhabit Jerusalem. They reestablish worship in the temple. They rebuild the temple. They build up the walls of the city, fortifying the city. But you don't find out about, and that's what the Old Testament really leaves off, is in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Then you get to the New Testament. What are the Jews doing there? They're worshiping God. You know, previously they lived under idolatry and they were back and forth serving God, then serving idols, and then God would punish them, and then they'd serve God again for a time, and they were in this cycle of worshiping God, then falling away. But you don't see that after their return from Babylon. And so you've got God's divine judgment there upon His people for their disobedience, but at the same time, He has seemed to, through this process, created a people that are more loyal to His law and to His service than in times past. They didn't waver anymore, according to, as we see and look at New Testament history and the Jews there. They didn't waver between idolatry and Old Testament worship anymore. They just worshiped God the way that they should. And so there's somewhat of this purifying process that then begins to take place. And you see in verse 2, God was the one behind it. God was the one that sought out to accomplish these things. And as Dave said, I believe that God's hand was involved here, but it wasn't involved in a miraculous way. We've got accounts for us in the Bible where God miraculously intervenes in certain battles. The Battle of Jericho comes to mind, where they march around the wall and the wall just falls down when the trumpets blow. God was miraculously involved in that. And you've got the other instance where Moses is holding his hands up, and when Moses' hands are held up, then the children of Israel win. When they go down, they lose. And so Aaron and Joshua, they go and they hold, hold up Moses' hands, and God miraculously brings about victory. That's not what we're seeing here, I don't think. I think we've got more so God working providentially, that is, behind the scenes. He doesn't divinely intervene in this instance, but what He does, and yes, it is His judgment that allows the children of Israel to fall into the hands of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. You look at verse 17, and we're going to get to that. We'll just read that. But verse 17 kind of uses a similar language to describe another event where you've got God involved. Regarding Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, verse 17 says, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So once again, you've got these young men who are intelligent, and we'll talk more about that when we get to that. But you've got God involved in that process. And so I do think you're going to see a little bit of the miraculous hand of God when we come into studying that particular verse. But in verse 3, or in verse 2, what you've got is God just allowing this army, this Nebuchadnezzar, and the Babylonians to come in and to bring destruction upon His people as means of punishment and as means of purification, I believe. So you see God's involvement there. Also in that text we read, Nebuchadnezzar, when he came in, he comes into the house of God and he carries off some of the temple treasure. And he takes that and he places that in the house of his God. Some of the articles of the temple are there as well. Not real sure exactly what happened here, because he's going to come in at a later point in time and he's going to absolutely destroy Jerusalem. He's going to deport the rest of the city. That is, anybody who's anybody, only the lowest people, the lowest and the poorest, are going to be left in the city, and they're later going to flee to Egypt. But at this point in time, he hasn't taken it and brought down the full wrath of the Babylonians on them. And when he goes in, he takes some of the temple treasure we see here. Now, whether Jehoiakim might have used some of that temple treasure to perhaps bribe King Nebuchadnezzar to just take a little bit and then go on back and we'll be your vassal, we'll serve under you, that might have been the case. That's what happened with Hezekiah. Whenever the Assyrian army came in, Hezekiah used some of the temple treasure to bribe them so that they might spare the nation of Judah, and not take them in. But whether that's the case here, Nebuchadnezzar leaves some of the vessels because you're going to have temple worshiping continue to a certain degree at this point in time. But you're going to see Jehoiakim later rebelling, and it's even when Jehoiakim rebels against Babylon that Nebuchadnezzar comes back, wages war on the city for a year and a half, and then tears down the walls and absolutely destroys and takes everything back to Babylon. What do you think the significance of that was? He takes some of these temple treasures and he places them in the house of his God. What's the relevance of that? at least maybe from his mind. Okay? Put them in subjection. He's demonstrating, you know, my God Marduk, he's more powerful than the God of the Judeans because he allowed us to come in. He gave us victory over their God. And so we're going to take some of their God's treasure, and essentially that's going to be some of the plunder that we take back. That's going to be a trophy for us to demonstrate our God's superiority over the God of the Israelites. And there was another instance you may remember way back in the Old Testament. I think it's in the book of 1 Samuel, where the Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant, and they take the Ark of the Covenant in, and they put it in the house of their god Dagon. And you see what God, you may remember what God did then. They woke up the next morning, and they went to the house of Dagon, and Dagon's idol was laying down flat in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And then disaster begins to strike, and they make sure to get rid of the Ark. But that usually was the purpose of taking some of these goods, placing them in the house of the conquering nation's god, because it demonstrated in their mind the superiority and the victory that their God gave them. So Nebuchadnezzar comes along, and in defeating the Judeans, he takes some of the temple treasure and he places that in the house of his God.
But also gives the impression to the Judeans, those who are still following God, that God's allowing this to happen.
Okay.
If he goes in and takes those articles, it goes with the first part of the verse there where God, the Lord, gave.
Right. Okay, right, exactly. You know, what's kind of interesting along that mindset is the king that replaces Jehoiakim, because Jehoiakim's later, he's going to rebel against the Babylonians. And you read the account of 2 Kings, he's going to be taken back to Babylon in bronze fetters, and that's where he's going to die. But what Nebuchadnezzar does is he's going to place another, a figurehead king to reign over Judah for a small amount of time by the name of Zedekiah. And all of the while, you've got to wonder, these prophets must just be terribly frustrated because Jeremiah's been telling the people of Judah, you need to submit to the Babylonians. This is God's judgment. God is the one who has ordered this edict for you to be in Babylonian captivity. You need to submit to their rule. And yet Zedekiah is going to, you know, try to kill Jeremiah because he didn't want to submit to the rule of the Babylonians. And as a result, they can't read the writing on the wall. And they've been told over and over and over. And you even see in this instance, the Babylonians are taking some of the temple treasure, the vessels that are used in worship to God, and they're taking them back, putting them in the house of their God. You know, it's very obvious here who God is sided with in this particular instance. But yet they continue to rebel, and they just don't seem to get the picture. It's obvious that some were listening, right? Some were listening to the prophets. And as we mentioned, Daniel is a contemporary of Jeremiah to a degree. You may remember Daniel, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah are the prophets who prophesied during this point in time. Jeremiah was in the city of Jerusalem, and that's where his prophetic ministry occurred. Daniel is in Babylon, in the house of Nebuchadnezzar, and that's where his prophetic work occurs. And Ezekiel was among the Israelites, the Jews, in the city of Babylon. So you've got those three prophets that are kind of three different locations and have three unique perspectives, all of them saying the same thing, essentially, submit to the king of Babylon. Jeremiah was a good bit older than Daniel. In fact, his ministry, I think, began 20 years prior to Daniel's. So it's possible that Daniel heard Jeremiah the prophet proclaiming, submit to Babylon. And so he goes over there, he realizes it's futile to resist, God has allowed these things to happen, and therefore, because of his attitude and his dealing with the Babylonians, his understanding of God being involved, you see that he then comes into good favor with the Babylonians, which we're going to see in verse 9. So, we've got there, verse 2, all of this is at the hand of God and is of the plan of God. Verses 3 and 4, the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. So, stop real quick for one of our questions. List some of the unique challenges that Daniel and his friends would face in Babylon. Okay? They're going to have to learn a new language. I think back to my high school days, I didn't do very good at Spanish. That was one of those, two of those required courses you had to take. It's not easy to speak a language your whole life and you understand that language, but then you try to learn a new one. That can be somewhat challenging. And so they're going to be faced with this task of learning this completely new language. Dave? They're going to be slaves. Okay? Now, you look at verse 3 here. What kind of men, I think we're going to jump ahead to one of our other questions, but what was one of the characteristics of the people that they were to bring back to Babylon? Royal family, some of the key descendants of some of the nobles. And it's been surmised that Daniel and his friends were possibly of noble birth. To what degree, we don't know. But they would have been accustomed somewhat to being, or their family being in this role of authority and of nobility. And as Dave mentioned, they're going to be taking the Babylonians into Babylon as slaves. So the role that there is completely going to change. Now, we're going to see Daniel is blessed by God, and as he rises up through the ranks of the citizens of Babylon, that he's going to achieve somewhat of an authoritative role. But that's not how it starts out. They start at the bottom of the ladder. They're nothing but slaves over in the city of Babylon, who previously of noble birth within the city of Jerusalem. Okay, so... Okay. And a couple times in the book, you're going to see a direct confrontation that the king says, do this, but the God that they serve says, don't do this. And what happens whenever the will of God and the will of the nation in which you live butts heads? You've got to make a decision. So they're going to be in direct opposition to some the practices that they're required are going to be in direct opposition to what they've been taught to do as Israelites. Johnny? Okay. You might not. Okay. And verses, I think it's 6 and 7, some of the dietary restrictions that the Jews had placed on them. We'll talk a little bit more specifically when we get to those verses. But it's going to be completely different than what they were used to eating. Because you may remember back in the book of Leviticus, there were a lot of things the Jews couldn't eat. So they're going to find themselves faced with the king's fare, and that's really their first challenge, their first task of where they're finding themselves as slaves in the city of Babylon, where God's will meets the will of their king. So, interesting to see. We'll find out in just a few verses what's going to happen there. Okay? What kind of people are we looking at? We're looking at seasoned adults, seasoned Jews that would have perhaps had their faith tested and developed and grown to a point of maturity. Okay? We'll look a little bit more... The Hebrew term the Bible uses to describe Daniel and his friends. But we're looking at young men. To say the least, we're looking at young men. Men, perhaps, whose faith is untested. Who don't have the maturity of age and experience. And haven't perhaps, or we're going to find out, maybe their faith has been challenged, maybe it hasn't. So we're going to find out. That's going to be a unique challenge. Them saying, okay, who am I going to serve? Who's it going to be? Is it going to be my king, Nebuchadnezzar? Is it going to be my God, Jehovah? And so we're going to find out. As we see a few verses down there, we're looking at young men. So this is... No, go ahead. Right. I mean, you look at pagan worship, sexual immorality, fornication was a major part of pagan worship. So, Robert mentioned, you got young men there, and guess what? Mom and dad aren't around. They were told to take back young people. And if you think of their purpose in doing so, for indoctrinating and making them Babylonians, they wouldn't want children with the influence of their parents there. So they don't have mom and dad around. They're going to be exposed to this culture shock, and they're going to be placed in a situation where there's going to be temptation that's unique to them, and this pagan worship that's going to be available, and mom and dad who might have kept that in the straight and narrow for a time when they were younger, aren't going to be around to provide that influence and that wisdom and that guidance and that instruction. And so they're going to be completely on their own. And you consider all of these factors, and you know what happens in Daniel. You know the gist of it. It's impressive to see these young men and the faith that they demonstrate when the odds are so completely set against them. You know, the circumstance and the culture is completely different than what they're used to. They're gone from nobility to being slaves in this place. The food they're being fed is different. The practices of the religion in this foreign country, their captive nation, is tempting, perhaps. And it's just amazing to see the faith of these young men to make the stand that they do. And the obedience, their service to God, it's something to be admired. Tommy? Great point. And we're going to, that's the very last question after we get through all the texts. We're going to just look at the chapter as a whole. What are some modern day applications? You know, these things were written for our learning. What can we learn? And I think that's a great lesson that the children are going to have to stand on their own one day. And if the parents haven't done a job of appropriately preparing their children for what they're going to face in the world, it's disastrous. I mean, you look at Jehoiakim, who was the son of Josiah. Josiah being one of the greatest, most righteous kings in Israel. But yet his son Jehoiakim was evil and hateful and selfish and all of these things that his father wasn't. And so, yes, children have to make their own decisions, but it's the responsibility of the parent to equip them with those things they need for fathers and mothers to nurture them in the admonition of the Lord so that they're able to deal with those challenges to their faith that are eventually going to come. So, any other questions or comments that we want to make in closing? Reached our time. Right. Mm-hmm. God is at work behind the scenes, and some might attribute this from the outside perspective and say, well, this is King Nebuchadnezzar. This is a mighty nation that is conquering a less than mighty nation. That's what you'd expect to happen. But God was involved. And if God wanted to, the city and the nation of Judah could have demolished the Babylonians. Just as simple as that. If God wanted that to happen, that had been the case. But as Steve said, this is the will of God. This was God's providential work in allowing the Babylonians to take the Judeans into captivity. Right. You take the nobles. And when Nebuchadnezzar was going through the temple church, he probably wasn't looking for second-class stuff. He was looking for the best. So I appreciate everyone's participation in our Bible study this morning.